Welcome to the Secure Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Springer and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome five-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
We are here to talk more about cybersecurity. Each episode will focus on a specific topic or two of interest to us. Today, we are talking about breach and attack simulation.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Breach and attack simulation is so much easier now. A couple hundred years ago, you had to rebuild the wall afterwards. Ridiculous.
Boo.
So, one of the most common things on the mind of security people is, are my detections working? Whether that's because of a tool that you purchased, whether it's content you've written in-house, or these days, as is frequent, the MSSP's content, whether that's working or not. That is a common question on my mind. So this can be surprisingly tough and time intensive to validate. And one of the ways to validate it, we talked about the other week, is purple teaming. This is kind of similar. We talked about that 2 weeks ago, and this is a natural outgrowth of that conversation. Breach and attack simulation is different from purple teaming in two ways. First of all, it is automated and it's continuous, which leads it to be much more scalable than a purple team. Purple team is a very hands-on thing.
Which is also why this is sometimes known as, why it is also known as continuous security validation.
It's much fancier than breach and attack simulation. But on the other hand, it's not nearly as flexible. In a purple team engagement, you can easily customize the engagement to whatever you want to test. But in a breach and attack simulation tool, you typically can only test what they have pre-programmed in the tool, or they may provide you with some method of scripting, maybe uploading your own bcaps or something. But generally speaking, it is a lot less flexible. So should you do breach and attack simulation or purple teaming? Well, I personally think that you should do both. I think that they fulfill different roles. Breach and attack simulation is more meant as content validation, continuous content validation, and purple teaming should be used for things like adversary simulation, or maybe for testing new items, new technologies, new contents, new detections.
And also part of that can be process validation as well. You know, are your processes working?
Yeah. Breach and attack simulation, it's a lot harder to, you know, simulate every single day that this alert came in. Hopefully on day two, they'll realize that it's the exact same IP address. And you probably cannot test your analyst that way, but you can test your analyst with purple teaming.
Well, actually, we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Oh my. So BAS, how does it work? It varies, but they typically all work on some variant of running bad stuff. That is incredibly broad, but sometimes it's very easy. For example, if you go look at Red Canary's Atomic Red Team, there are a number of little self-contained tests where you can do things like create a registry run key or run a malicious PowerShell command or something like that. So sometimes they're just running little scripts that do something that a bad guy does, which is helpful because a lot of bad guys, of course, these days are doing the whole living off the land thing. They're using built-in tools in Windows. So these tools do the same thing. Sometimes that's a little harder. For example, the breach and attack simulations typically don't want to download and run actual malware on your system. It would be very embarrassing for them if they infected your systems with WannaCry because they were trying to demonstrate, you know, whether you're vulnerable to WannaCry or not. Another thing that's pretty hard is exploiting web applications. This is another place where it's probably better to let your purple or red team do it. I don't think I've ever heard of a breach and attack simulation that's good at, you know, demonstrating IIS exploits.
But they usually do this via one of three ways. They'll use a vendor-built appliance, purpose-built appliance that's designed to attack and to be attacked. They'll ask for, or they'll utilize a production, or not necessarily production, but they'll use a server that's built by the organization, and then they'll install software on it. So it is basically an appliance that's designed to be part of the breach and attack simulation environment, or they'll install an agent on a production system. And that agent will be essentially what gets attacked or does the attacking.
Do you have any thoughts, David, on which one of these is the best method? I know I feel like the vendor-built appliance is probably the worst one, Because the other two at least use your build of Windows and your own, you know, logging setup and all that.
Personally, I like the build your system, install the agent on it so that you have a custom, basically a custom built appliance. I don't like the idea of installing an agent on a production system because anybody who's worked in security for any period of time and done and worked with agents knows that anytime there's any problem, it will be the agent's fault and the agent will be uninstalled. It's guilty until proven innocent.
That
situation.
I used to run McAfee HIPS, and that was the number one. Every time anything went wrong, that was like 90% of my job was proving that McAfee HIPS didn't do it or fixing it if it did.
Right. And the first thing they want you to do is turn it off.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I would try to avoid that as much as possible, telling them, look, if I turn it off, then how can we be sure that this is what is actually causing the problem or not?
Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, management would probably come in and step in and say, yeah, uninstall it or turn it off or whatever. And then it would be weeks of them figuring out what the real problem was before you got to turn it back on or reinstall it. And, you know, I was kind of thinking about this when we were, building up this article or this talk about whether you could build your own with Nessus, Metasploit, and maybe some custom scripts and alerts.
I think you absolutely can. Because I was just talking about the Atomic Red Team one. Like, you can set it up so that, because each of the Atomic Red Team tests is a simple Ruby or PowerShell script. So yeah, you could set them up to run just in a row, you know, set up sort of a master script. I actually did this for a attack simulation I was doing for a phishing related. I put together what was a plausible attack chain using Atomic Red Team tests and then ran them on the system to create logs for an exercise for people to go find those logs. So you could 100% set up a PowerShell script or some kind of script that just runs these, you know, every day at the same time and runs them one after the other, and then set up, you know, your SIM search to see if it detects it or not. Probably wouldn't be quite as robust as a purchase tool maybe, but I think you could definitely do this on the cheap. And then like you're talking about using Nessus or using a vulnerability scanner to mimic some of those more exploit ones, like test, cross-site scripting. Wait, that's not going to be detectable. That would be detectable on the web server logs, and test like SQL injection, stuff like that, directory traversal. So I think you could test all those pretty easily this way.
Yeah. I mean, one of the main things that you would miss out on, and we'll get more into it later, is some of the metrics capabilities that these companies have spent time built in for the reporting capabilities.
Yeah, especially because you wouldn't necessarily know where the gap was. Because with what I'm talking about, I guess there's you could check with the SIM if the data made it into the SIM, and you could check with the SIM if the alert fired. But you'd have trouble like validating, you know, did it successfully run or not? Like, when it doesn't show up one morning, is that because the script failed to run? Is that because the logging broke down somewhere?
Right. And whether, you know, where that attack fits into any kind of framework you're using and to guide your security program as well.
Yeah, you'd have to custom build all that, which is of course why they're charging for this, because they've gone ahead and done it and it's easier for you. So one of the nice things about if you do use one of your own systems rather than a vendor built appliance is you can set it up for your logging and protection how you want it. Now the kind of the level zero here is you use a default, you know, your gold image to install it. You use your default logging, whatever that is. You use your default AV, et cetera, et cetera. And then you run it, and that'll test how your current posture looks like. But you can test, you can look at, oh, you know, I wonder if we set this logging or if we set this blocking, if it'll actually block this, and then test and validate that. So another one we have seen in the past is some of these will allow you to set up multiple agents and then run attacks between them across the network, which is very helpful because host-based is great, but host-based isn't everything.
Yeah, and the advantage of that, having the multiple agents and systems attack each other, is those can be more closely aligned to actual attacks versus, and some of this will be defanged and some of it won't be, but preventing that from getting out and actually harming production boxes. and yet still getting the outcome that you're looking for being able to see the actual attack. And now when you go with one of these vendors, the tool should be configured to get the alerts and maybe logs directly from the tools and systems, as well as the SIM. So doing this will show that, you know, the attack was seen by your security tools, that the attack was alerted on, that the logs are actually getting into your logging platform or your SIM, and that you actually had alerting built into the SIM to identify those attacks actually took place, which will bring it to the attention of your analysts.
Yeah, this is just like when we discussed with the Purple team. There's a whole bunch of different places content can go wrong. And the more places that the tool can validate for you, the easier it is on your part.
And the more confident you can be in your environment, end to end, your detection and monitoring is working as expected.
Because that's always the question you get, right? Your C-level is always like, well, would we have detected this? And usually the answer has to be qualified. It's things like, well, we have content to detect it, or we have the logs turned on to detect it. But unless you've actually tested it and validated it, you don't know for certain. And again, Purple Team can do this, but the Purple Team can't test everything all at once. Whereas a breach and attack simulation, once it's set up, it can test literally everything in the library within the space of a day and then turn around and do it again tomorrow. So not only do you know that it works, but you know it worked recently, as opposed to I tested it once when it went into production 12 months ago, and hopefully nobody's touched it since then.
Right.
Because nobody does that. Nobody changes things in production.
No, never.
Never.
Especially not without change control.
Yeah. So what can you do with breach and attack simulation? Well, kind of the first thing that everybody wants to do is test their content detections. And kind of on my mental model here, there's like four levels where you can test it. You can just install it on a single host in your environment. And once everything's hooked up, then you can validate that your content works. And that's kind of level zero. That's usually kind of a POC level thing. So level two, put an agent between multiple enclaves or multiple departments, especially if you're a large company that's geographically dispersed and you don't have a centralized IT function. I think it'd be really interesting to kind of stick one of these agents in each of the major areas. And that way you still don't have, you know, hundreds of agents out there, but you're going to start to get an idea of, well, the content works the way we think it should in IT maybe, but over here in marketing, we're not getting all the logs we think we should.
And you should also consider remote offices and remote workers, remote workforce as part of those different sections or different departments.
Yeah, I can see, especially depending on how IT is set up, if those remote offices have their own IT, they may not follow, especially if they're a remote office in a place that's super remote and they can't get assistance. They may do things like, you know, any on the firewall because someone's having trouble getting into something. I mean, they could do that at the corporate network too. It could happen anywhere. I shouldn't throw shade on them just because they're remote.
Right. Well, I mean, some of these remote offices that have bandwidth constraints too, which means it's more difficult to centrally manage them because the ability to send the data is necessary to do all the management overhead across that small pipe that office is relying on. So sometimes they operate in a semi-autonomous fashion. Yeah. And, you know, maybe they don't always, or the updates to attempt to make them look like everybody else is less frequent than the other parts of the organization.
Now, I've definitely seen that before with vulnerability scanning to remote offices with bandwidth concerns, like where vulnerability scanning doesn't complete. So you don't really, maybe stuff's not getting patched. Issues aren't being noticed. One definite place to look there is on-prem versus cloud. You'll probably find that you have different security settings in each of them. Then level three, once you've accomplished that, this is kind of my scoping. You start off with one, then you spread it to a couple places in different departments. Then you work on, if possible, getting these in all of your different subnets. Because again, what you're going to find is you're going to find that some subnets have a lot more protections than others. And some subnets are going to be well protected and others may be wide open.
And if you can't get it to all of them, you at least attempted to get it where you have one in each enclave that's separated by a security device of some kind, whether it be a firewall or an IDS or something.
That's fair. Yeah, every subnet maybe a little. Every subnet maybe a little much because some of these charged by the agent. So if you've got like 50 or 100, offices, it may get a little expensive.
Yeah. So every security boundary that's crossed, try to get one in there if you can.
That's a smarter way to do it. Yep. And finally, level 4, added by David, test attacks and data exfiltration traversing the org's network edge. You know, what does it look like when the attacks are going out? Would you see it if your org was attacking somebody else? Would you see it if your org was exfiltrating data?
Well, or being attacked. So,
via a cloud node of some kind.
Right. Yep. Yeah. So whether you have an AWS instance or an Azure instance where you can put one of these agents, or if the company, you know, your vendor has one from their network they can use.
Number two use case, tell you when the content stops working. And this is the advantage that breach attack simulation has over purple teaming. Both purple teaming and breach attack simulation can help you test if your content works. One of them is faster than the other one, but one of them is more, you know, comprehensive and customizable. But you can run this every single day. You might be able to run it every hour. I don't know how many use cases you're running and how long it takes, but that's something you can do every single day. And then you can check in your SIM if the alert pops. And if the alert does not pop one morning, then you set off an alert because that means something broke. The logging broke, the rule broke, something in the chain broke. And that needs to be, this is actually kind of related to one of the talks in Splunk that we discussed a couple of weeks ago, where that's their first check in every shift is to validate that the content is working. That's, you would go to the dashboard in your SIM that shows, you know, hopefully everything green, every alert fired. And if something didn't work, then you have to open a ticket with the engineering team.
Yeah. And if the vendor's tool is integrated with your ticketing system, those tickets can be popped off automatically.
Even better. Although just judging by how often data sources go down in our SIM, I don't know if they'd be real thrilled by that.
Well, it might be depending on where the failure is at. You create the ticket. Yeah. And it may be just a ticket for your internal team to look into it. And you could do this by having a, because if you have your, depends on how your organization is structured, but if you are your analyst looking at a SIM dashboard, maybe you want to pop up an informational alert in your SIM dashboard that the analyst can then action or investigate to see if they need to create a ticket in the ticketing system or something like that as well. And this can also be beneficial not only to see when the test gets worse, but maybe when things improve as well. So if you're running an attack or run a simulation across one certain network segment, and you know you've got 10 greens and 5 reds, and then that switches from 10 greens to 11 or 12, it might be beneficial to investigate why that change took place also, so that you can continually understand or improve your understanding of how the environment is functioning.
No, and you're right. Again, one of the reasons that the alert could fail is because a protective technology went in place too. And you may have to adjust your detection. Like, you know, if you started blocking at the firewall, then the attack will have failed and you may not detect it on the other side of that firewall.
Yeah. And sometimes IT teams will do things that they say are in the, or they think are improving security without telling the security team that they've made those changes.
Never.
I mean, not saying that IT teams don't understand security, but sometimes they make assumptions about what the security team wants or what the security team thinks is beneficial and what they don't.
That's fair. Another use case for this is to validate your logging and alerting. This is, again, kind of related to what we talked about, the purple team. There's a long chain between when a log is generated and when the alert is generated in the SIM. This can help you validate what part of it is correct or not. Is it the content or is it the logging? So, for example, if you have multiple agents attacking each other between subnets, this one's always kind of a tough one, is making sure you're logging everything between all the subnets. Although this may not be the most efficient way to do that, as David was mentioning before, since these can be charged by the agent, it may not be super efficient to put one agent in every subnet, but at least you could, you know, put one in each security boundary, on each side of each security boundary, and validate that those are all logging. It may let you know if the level of logging you've determined is the appropriate level. If you, you know, put this on a gold image and half of the stuff is not detected, that may be a detection problem, a content problem, or it may be a logging problem. It may tell you if you're missing the logging in various subnets. And then systems with different EDR policies and different GPO settings. This one is kind of related to what I was talking about before. If you've got stuff in different enclaves, marketing may have different GPO settings than IT does, and you may need to look at standardizing those.
You can also use it to create metrics for your leadership. We were talking about this earlier about, you know, if you roll your own, some of the challenges or some of the benefits you don't get from that. So you can present reports to, you know, the actual engineers or the people who are going to improve things, as well as to your leadership about, you know, how good is your logging compared to the standard that you've set for the organization? You know, are you getting the logging coverage that you expect from all your assets? Like, you know, if you have 50 database servers and you're not getting all the logs from all 50, can that show up in there? And of course, there's the content coverage versus the MITRE framework or other attack frameworks. And if you run these attacks and each attack actually has an indicator, which MITRE TTP is associated with that attack, then that can then present to you the MITRE chart as a heat map graphic, giving you red and green for the different TTPs across the network or for different segments. Yeah.
And it can even get more detailed than that. I did a quick POC on a tool, I think a year or two ago. I won't mention which one it was, but they, for example, tried something like 10 different methods of command and control. And then, you know, told me like command and control via DNS failed, command and control via HTML 80 succeeded, you know, via HTML 8080 succeeded, via HTTPS failed, like the various, like all the different methods of doing command and control. They just hit all of them one after the other and were like, these three were blocked and these four were successful and none of them were detected or something like that.
Yeah. And if you're testing multiple subnets, that may be end up being a shading as well. You know, CNC for DNS failed 9 out of 10 times based on the number of agents that are deployed. So maybe that gets an orange versus a red or
a
green.
And you know, that's probably where the most value comes from the pre-built tools, because that's something that trying to build that out yourself would be a real pain. And then trying to build out the dashboard and the color coding and making it visible and easy to use. I think you could do something with Atomic Red Team and with like Nessus and Nexpose pretty easily and get kind of a base level of capability pretty easily. But yeah. Yeah, I don't know that I would try to do that over multiple subnets or multiple enclaves. And then try to put that all into a single readable dashboard. It's a lot of work.
Yeah. And if you're weighting the MITRE framework against your priorities, then you can see, well, these TTPs are a priority for us and these are red. So let's work on fixing those, even though, you know, maybe 10 other columns or 500 rows or whatever, what have you in the MITRE framework are red also. You're like, well, we're not worrying about those because those are not our priorities. So we know where to focus our work at, because these five that are probably are green, but these five that are red need to be fixed.
That's where your threat intel comes in. Go to that MITRE navigator and figure out what types of attackers are hitting you, or frankly, just what types of, you know, MITRE techniques they're likely to use. You know, malicious URLs, malicious executables, malicious documents, PowerShell. Like those are the major ones they use, and hit those first.
Right, and you can reference back to that Splunk talk we mentioned a couple of weeks ago about that whole concept as well. And of course, you can always use these as well to, as part of testing new security tools that you haven't purchased yet as far as POCs, because you'll get uniformity of attack against all the different tools. So you know that you're making the exact same test and the tools are all responding to the exact same thing, and you get a baseline comparison to say this tool caught it, this tool didn't. Maybe even be able to make adjustments to the tool to say, well, this tool didn't work because this, and we'll change that setting and now it works, and help you determine whether a new security tool is worth the money or not, and which one out of a group is better than others.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting too, because a lot of times when we do these POCs, it's usually one person manually running things, and they try to, you know, you try to be as similar as possible, but when it's a human running things, you know, the timing's a little different. You may forget to run one of the tests. You may, you know, try to dump 100 malware samples past it or whatever, and you may only, you know, do 98 on one of them. It can be difficult. It can be difficult to do it exactly the same way.
Yeah, and if you have multiple people, that even decreases the likelihood that's going to be done.
Yeah, you're right. Yep.
So two other things you can do for or use this for as well is testing employees, both potential and current. So if you're testing potential employees to see what their skill level is at, see if they're as knowledgeable as a resume claims, then you can sit them down in front of a console. And what I would say suggest is, you know, don't sit them in front of your production console. Have a test console for them to look at and, you know, run the attacks in there and see if they're able to, if they're going to catch what you expect.
You know, that is one of my favorite things, not necessarily with breach and attack simulation, but always one of my favorite things to do with a potential hire is throw some technical questions in front of them, throw some, you know, SQL injection logs and see what they know. I'm consistently surprised by the number of people who can pick their way through a log and figure out what's going on, but may have trouble answering questions like, you know, what would you do first? Zipping and encrypting and stuff like that. So no tricksy questions here. Just tell me what the log says.
Yeah. And the other side of that is testing your current employees. You know, Matt was talking about how you don't want to get them used to that.
Yeah.
So I would recommend a tool that can integrate with your IPS and DNS management system to rotate the host names and IP addresses. So the analysts don't get used to seeing the same IPs and the same host names in their logs to say, oh, well, I know that's just a test and I'm not going to pay any attention to that.
Yeah, you'd also need it to adjust the order it runs the tests into, because if they see the same stuff coming through in the same order.
So. Well, I mean, what you do is just, they have pretty, I don't know about huge, but they have large libraries. Mm-hmm. So I would not even run the same test in a year, just a different test once a month. And maybe it's a, you know, SQL injection this time, maybe it's a some kind of a ransomware attack this other time or something like that. Don't keep it a secret from your employees that this is going to happen. Tell them, you know, once a month, you're going to be tested using our attack breach and simulation capability. And we're going to expect you to respond to those tests as if they were actual incidents. And this will be part of your evaluation. And this will incentivize them to treat every potential incident as an actual incident because they could be a test, which they don't want to dismiss or fail to respond to.
Interestingly enough, when I was doing research for this discussion today, I saw that Mandiant has already declared that breach and attack simulation is outdated. It's over. It's not even, as far as I can tell, like a commonplace installed tool everywhere yet. And they're already done with it.
Yeah. And they bought an attack simulation tool 2 years ago.
Veriden. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is one of the market leaders. Yeah. And in this article that you're referencing here, it says historically teams have relied on breach and attack simulation activities. Like, I don't know where, maybe at Mandiant they rely on it. But this technology is really, I mean, what's it, 5 years old now, maybe?
Yeah, well, yeah, because they were all in. What's that stupid venture capital term where they're secret?
Stealth.
Yeah, they were all in stealth mode 4 or 5 years ago. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when we were first looking at them, because we discussed with one of the vendors why they were still in stealth mode, and someone else had just come out of stealth mode, and yeah, it was the big thing 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, so it's still really new.
Yeah.
When you're talking about security technologies, and to say historically. You know, like this, you know, this stuff has been out for 10 or 15 years or longer, is just ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. There was another article I found on Forbes, written by a Mandiant VP, who's the VP of the, what is it? What do they call it? They called it security validation. He's their VP of security validation. So obviously he's a little biased, but he had a number of complaints that we'll kind of go through here because I think they're super interesting. So his first one was they lack critical functionality needed for, and a lot of these are quotes, they lack critical functionality needed for continuous validation of security performance across as organization security infrastructure. And the critical functionality he calls out is they don't perform real attacks.
Yeah, which is not true.
Yeah, in fact, one of the ones we looked at, what they do is they perform real attacks and they record it over PCAP and they replay those real attacks. And also a number of them use the living off the land tools like the Red Canary atomic red team tests. That's the exact same stuff that an attacker uses. Using PowerShell by the machine is no different than the attacker using PowerShell.
Yeah, and most of these vendors as well, if you have your own PCAP with an attack in it, you can feed it in and it will run that PCAP.
Yeah, which would actually is really cool because we didn't talk about that, but that's how you support custom content. Like if you've got, you know, special sauce because of maybe you want to do some of that web exploitation stuff and you have a red team or a purple team, you can have them do that attack once, record it, and then start playing it all across the enterprise to see if you detect it. He also says they only do post-exploit attacks, which is not true. Definitely seen, like the Atomic Red Team stuff is mostly post-exploit stuff, but I've seen these vendors who have malware samples. They have scanning samples. They have command and control samples. They have, that's what I'm looking for, persistence attacks. So it's definitely not all just post-exploit. Although honestly, I think the post-exploit ones are probably the more valuable. Honestly, I've never found a good detection for reconnaissance activity. It's always too noisy.
Yeah, I mean, you're most likely to catch them after that's already passed.
Well, I mean, once the malware is downloaded, like that's really. Yeah. They do incomplete attacks, which may not be alerted, may not be detected. I don't know that that's true. They may not be alerted on. I can kind of see his point here where if it's doing atomic tests where it's just doing the run key and then it's just doing a, you know, lateral movement via RDP or something where maybe it's not detected because, you know, a machine learning or an AI system doesn't detect it in that way. It doesn't, you know, meet the threshold of risk or something like that. But each of those things should still be detected by your logging system. And you should be able to write a detection in your SIM that'll say, was this unique atomic action detected?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of your defense in depth as well. Is, you know, if it wasn't detected here, you know, where else could it be detected at?
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't need to necessarily just save the alerts too, because, you know, every time a run key is created, you probably want to save that for IR purposes down the road. If you find malware, you know, a month later and go back and figure out how it got on there. He said they're not informed by threat intel, which I think is frankly BS. While yes, there's definitely kind of a function for threat intel here in terms of introducing new attacks, which a lot of these vendors are doing. They're constantly expanding their library. But I think the threat intel here is usually used for focusing your efforts on things you have time for. A breach and attack simulation tool can run every one of their tests every day. You can test everything in their library. You don't need to, you know, you don't only have time to run 8 tests and have to make sure you only run the 8 most important tests.
Yeah, it's all a matter of how much time do you have.
Yeah.
You know, how much can you cram into 24 hours?
Yeah. And the threat intel thing, like each of these tool vendors has a team that's, you know, trying to follow up. We had a briefing with one of the tool vendors. They told us like they've got a specialized red team who is watching the threat intel feeds and trying to build content for the new attacks ASAP.
And actually talking about, you know, how often you can run this stuff, you also have to consider that when you're running this stuff, this is going into all your logs. So if you have any kind of limitation or like that in your logging, then consider that this is just adding to the pile for each tool and your logging solution as well. So if you wanted to run this 24/7, you could certainly do that, but this is creating events in your logging solutions, in your tools,
the whole time. I think you're probably going to have to write almost, you're going to have to do something to ignore those events in your SIM. I mean, you want them, like, it's a weird one because you kind of, like, let's say Splunk, you want it to fire a notable event so that it validates that the content works, but then simultaneously you want to ignore or automatically close those notable events. Based on maybe the IP address or something, so that you're not, you know, flooding your analysts with events they have to manually close.
Right. You want to suppress them so they don't end up on the dashboard.
Yep.
Well, I mean, that's for the continuous validation part, not for, like we were talking about, those monthly tests that you want to run in order to test your analysts.
Yeah. So he also said that breach and attack simulation tools lack content supporting attack frameworks like MITRE ATT&CK and NIST. I find that hard to believe. I looked up one of his competitors, Attack IQ, and it's obviously right there on their capabilities page. And I'm sure that every other one does. Everybody does at this point.
Well, I know that's not true, at least based on four specific attack simulation vendors that I've dealt with.
Yeah. Now, there may be a question about keeping it updated. I saw that MITRE ATT&CK was just updated again, and that just makes me cry trying to keep up with that.
Well, they do that biannually. I think it's March and October.
Yeah, so. I think I found out about March and like really looked at it in like September. And then they updated it a month later. he said that breach and attack solutions don't support all systems. Well, yeah, but no product does. I don't know that that's really, is he suggesting that his continuous validation product does support all systems?
Yeah, well, like Solaris or AIX or?
I don't know, this whole article.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, the gist of the whole thing, I think is not accurate, really, because even from the beginning of breach and attack simulation tools, a lot of the tools, if not all of them, were already basically doing continuous evaluation concepts or activities, and was never strictly breach and attack sim as he's portraying it or describing it in the article anyway.
I'm actually wondering, because again, Mandiant, this article is by a VP at Mandiant, they purchased Veridin, which was a breach and attack simulation. So it sounds to me like what they've done is they've taken Veridin and they're trying to add something else on top of it. He mentions monitoring environmental drift and some of the other things he said in there made me wonder if they just threw a vulnerability scanner on top of it and combined those things.
No, I think what he's talking about environmental drift is the same thing we mentioned where, you know, you run an attack across this boundary.
Oh, and it changed. The results changed.
So the environment has drifted, so you're alerted to that. I think what they've simply done is they've taken Veridin, they've continually improved it over the last 2 years, and he's making a specious argument that, you know, Veridin or whatever they're calling their tool is, you know, echelons above those old antiquated breach and attack simulation vendors. So I think it's just a marketing ploy to try to separate them from everyone else in the space.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that there's not variation. There's a vendor that I've worked with recently whose breach and attack simulation is very limited. It just only does the host-based stuff and only like 10 or 12 use cases, plus maybe some scanning. So there definitely is a wide range of capabilities, but I think that's more of a function of how large the company is and how big kind of their engineers are. I need to find a way to rephrase that. I just called them fat.
Well, take a second. Go ahead and try it again.
Or I could leave it. I think it really depends on the breach and attack simulation vendors, you know, and how dedicated they are to producing that extra content. And it's probably going to vary by price point, of course, as well. You know, this vendor that I mentioned that only has, you know, 12 or 15 use cases and they're all host-based, almost all host-based, that product is thrown in free as part of a suite versus a dedicated vendor.
Right. And as long as they offer the ability to do customization, you can also improve it yourself. Just depends on how much time you have to invest in it.
Yeah. And that's definitely still probably better than starting from scratch.
Yeah. But the opportunity is there to start from scratch if you really don't have the means or the financial wherewithal, but you do have the time to do this yourself. It just takes some imagination.
And time. Imagination and time.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to the Security Serengeti podcast. Follow us on Twitter @SerengetiSec and download and listen to us on your favorite podcast app.